40 years ago, Monty Python released the classic comedy Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the movie often listed as one of the funniest of all time. It was co-directed by the only American member of the troupe, Terry Gilliam. He went on to direct other award-winning films like Time Bandits, Brazil, and 12 Monkeys. And now, on the eve of his 75th birthday, he's released an illustrated memoir called Gilliamesque. Doug Gordon caught up with him.
Terry, the cover of your new book, Gilliamesque, is suitably Gilliamesque. There's a photo of your head with the top sliced open, and there are all these animated figures popping out, including, of course, the famous Monty Python foot. And it says on the cover that the book is a pre-posthumous memoir. What does that mean?
Correct.
Why?
Because it's just an honest statement. It's very simple. I'm not dead yet, and that's about it. The publisher said, oh, but shouldn't that be preposterous? No, it's preposthumous.
Yeah, but it has to do with this whole thing that happened last month with Variety, right?
No. We had the book all published and finished long before Variety killed me.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The fact that Variety killed me, they were obviously just jumping on the bandwagon. They wanted to be there.
Okay, my mistake. And I wondered how that could have happened with it so close to the publication date. Okay, thank you for clarifying that. So tell me about how Variety killed you.
Well, I had been in France with my wife, came back and discovered I had been dead. Actually, by the time I learned about it, I had already been resurrected. But there were those missing hours that I didn't realize that I was experiencing the afterlife. I just thought it was another boring airplane flight. But that's the afterlife for me. Somebody, and it's not really been explained to me, how somebody at Variety pushed the button that triggered the headline that said, Monty Python's Terry Gilliam, director of Brazil, dead at XX. X, and below that was by obituary. But somebody did that, and I don't know if whether they had seen an ad or some reference to my preposthumous memoir and jumped the gun, because this happened just, in fact, the book had come out in England. There's another odd thing, because it dies at XXX, because they hadn't obviously put the date in yet, but XXX is 30. Yeah, it's 30. And the day before was the 30th anniversary of Brazil in America. That's what's very odd. So there are forces at work that we do not understand.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting. And I responded to it saying, you know, that I had died from so many bad reviews from Variety.
Yeah, and then a lot of tweets with Python references that people...
Of course,
Like Variety has downgraded Terry Gilliam from dead to merely a flesh wound, and Terry Gilliam is not dead, he's resting, he's stunned, he's pining for the fjords.
The whole thing was just incredibly funny and perfectly timed, I thought, for the promotion of this book.
Yeah, it's perfect. Did this whole really surreal experience change the way you viewed your life and your impending demise, which we hope is still many years away? Decades even.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the interesting thing is when my wife and I started having children, she suddenly became aware of her own mortality. And she never thought about her death before. And I said, I've thought about my death every day. What I do. Maybe it's because, you know, keep your enemies close.
Yeah.
So hold death close to your chest and it won't happen.
Sure.
On the other hand, it's like laughing at death, because I've decided death has no sense of humor. So the more you laugh at it, maybe the longer it'll stay at bay.
Yeah. That's a good attitude. The title of your book is Gilliamesque. How would you define Gilliamesque?
I don't know. I mean, this is always about when people talk about my films. Oh, they understand exactly. That's very Gilliamesque. It's your style, blah, blah, blah. I honestly don't know what they're talking about, because I just do what I want to do. I do what inspires me or excites me at any moment. And I never try to analyze what I do. I don't want to know. I like to keep the whole process, even for myself, slightly mysterious and just go with the flow when it's flowing.
And thank you for saying process, because I'm Canadian, and as you maybe have been able to tell, and the process down here really drives me nuts. So that's great.
Process?
Yeah, process. I know. It's process. But I would think that one of the most difficult creative challenges you faced in your career was making this move from being this one-man operation, creating animation for Python, and then moving from that into what's, you know, this really isolated work you're doing, into what's probably probably the most collaborative art form there is, film directing. How did you make this transition?
It began by directing Holy Grail and then realizing I don't want to direct the Pythons ever again.
Why not?
At that point, I wasn't particularly good at verbalizing exactly what I wanted and why it was needed to be done in that way. And they were impatient because they just wanted to get on and do the jokes. And I was doing more complicated things, making the sketches work, trying to create this world, the real world of the Middle Ages. And I realized, no, that's not going to work. But when I did Jabberwocky the first time on my own, it was that moment when I'm working with these terrific actors, these great famous comedians, and I, as the director, would say, do this, and they did it without arguing. Whoa, this is amazing. This is kind of fun. And so it started rather easily. The technical side of it, I just seemed to know how to do it. I just seemed to be quite easy. And communicating ideas to the technical people was easy. And in a sense, it was a nice change from, one could argue, the loneliness of the long-distant animator.
I like that. That's great. That could have been an alternate title, not as good as Gillian Mask. That would make it, that'll be the sequel. You got to write a sequel,
great,
the memoir.
Thank you.
That's great. I love that. One of the other big creative challenges you faced was moving from the two-dimensional world of animation to the three-dimensional world of live-action films. How did you pull that off?
I was surprised that I have this really good spatial sense just on that level. I can see things in 3D, even though I was working in 2D on the animation. It was easy. That's what bothers me. There's a certain thing that happens. It's happened several times in my life. It's like when I, before Python started, I learned to airbrush using the airbrush. And nobody ever taught me. I just saw Robert Grossman was a very good airbrush artist in America in the 60s. And I said, oh, I'll try to do that. And I taught myself. Almost everything I know how to do, I taught myself. I didn't go to school. And yeah, it's always surprised me. It always reminds me of it's like a musician who will pick up, say, a trumpet and just start playing it. And I've been lucky in that sense. So now I learned I get better. Or maybe, no, quite often it's just the opposite. I start with some kind of innate ability, which I lose the longer I start doing whatever I'm doing. So now I have no idea how you direct a movie.
It's interesting. I was struck by the fact that you said it's easy. That's what bothers me. So are you saying then, do you think that art should be more of a struggle? Has it not been enough of a struggle for you?
Yeah, but you put your finger on it, because I had this romantic idea of sort of a 19th century artist in a garret starving to death, that you had to suffer for your art.
Yeah.
And I was raised by parents who didn't abuse me. I wasn't a member of any oppressed minority. I wasn't a woman. I wasn't gay. I wasn't starving. And so I thought, what chance do I have as an artist? That's when I moved to New York and started working on the pain element.
Yeah. You've made a lot of great films like Time
Thanks.
Bandits, Brazil, The Fisher King and 12 Monkeys, and many others. Is that there's something that a unifying factor, something that you think all your films have in common?
I don't know. I mean, I think on many of them, at least, there is that battle between fantasy and reality. There is that. How far can your imagination take you before reality runs over you? There's clearly a sense of anti-authoritarian attitude in there. And there's also, in many ways, the innocence of a child, the pure way they see the world. They see the world more honestly. It's either a child or a lunatic is like that. So they tend to be in the films.
Yeah, you say that your films have always been repositories of idealism. And I think when you're a child, that's one of the times when idealism really runs high and you tend to be more idealistic. And then as you get older, reality kind of bashes it out of you.
I think the other problem, too, for me is where childhood and youth is all about so much to explore, so much to learn, so much to discover, all the vast world that's out there that you don't know. So there's all of that that you're aspiring to knowing more about. And as you get older, it goes the opposite direction. I'm not surprised anymore. I know too much.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that is depressing.
Oh,
when
yeah,
you see humanity repeats the same mistakes, the same stupidity goes on and on. It's like, as a species, we don't seem to be very good at learning.
Yeah. You say that one of the main misunderstandings of your films comes from the kind of trailer speak where the man with the deep voice says, "We're going into the mind of Terry Gilliam."
Yeah.
You add, that's the last place you want to be, and that's the reason you make films, so you don't have to be stuck in your own mind. And it makes me wonder, raises the question in my mind, what's wrong with being in the mind of Terry Gilliam? It seems to me it's a very imaginative, interesting, and fascinating place to be.
Only when I'm making a movie or talking on the radio about my life. The reality, as my wife will attest to, is miserable. I'm a grouch. I'm a grump. I'm a curmudgeon. I don't speak when I'm at home. I grouse around the place.
Yeah, I find that hard to believe, but I'll take you at your word. If you want a bad place to be, you should try being inside my head. That's a house of horrors.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's bad. It's bad. I was surprised to learn that you created an idea for a theme park attraction, an idea for an attraction called the Body Ride. Can you tell me about that?
Well, years ago in Britain, somebody had the bright idea of doing a kind of British Disneyland, and they asked me to do the Body Ride. It was going to start with a great bowl of soup, it looked like, and you'd get in pea pods and hollowed out corn cobs and carrots. You would ride the food in to a great big mouth with chomping teeth and then be sucked down into the gut. You're going to have to deal with antacid pills being dropped down trying to stop things. And you probably escaped into the bloodstream. And we know where the ride ended, don't we?
I think we did. You don't need to say.
It didn't happen, but at least this last year we've had in Britain Dismal Land, Banksy.
Yeah, with Banksy. Well, I was going to say maybe it's time for a Terry Gilliam theme park, like we could call it, I don't know, Gilliam Land? What do you think?
Well,
what would that look like? What would a Terry Gilliam theme park look like?
Well, I just have to steal from all my films. I'd steal from myself is how it would work. It'd be wonderful, but it's not going to happen, so I don't spend too much time dreaming of these things. That's what impressed me about Dismal Land, because I'm a huge Banksy fan. I think he's just wondrous.
He's downright Banksian, isn't he?
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Banks-esque. Banksy-esque. Banksy-esque.
That rolls off the tongue better, yes.
Yeah, we'll keep the esque thing going for the day.
Terry Gilliam is the author of Gilliam-esque. He talked with Doug Gordon. That was a very Gordon-esque interview. By the way, this is music from the soundtrack to Gilliam's 1985 movie, Brazil.